Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu. Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. In this part of Focus, we have a story that says something about the connections, sometimes subtle, between different ecosystems, between animals and human beings, and how it's important, if we understand particularly the way diseases are passed around, to understand those connections. And our guest for the program is Patricia Conrad. She's professor of veterinary medicine at University of California at Davis. She's also Aldo Leopold Fellow at the Stanford Institute for the Environment. And we'll be talking about some work that she and her colleagues there at UC Davis have been doing, taking a look at particular problems in sea otters that live in the water there off the coast of California, and how it is they seem to be getting sick as a result of something that happens on the land some ways away. We'll talk a little bit about this story here in this part of the show, and of course, we'd be very happy to have questions from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call. By the way, I do also want to mention Patricia Conrad is here to give the biennial Norman Levine Honorary Lecture, honoring Norman Levine, who was here at the University of Illinois for a number of years, a very important figure in the fields of parasitology and protozoology, which is her field, so that it's natural that she would be here to give this talk. She'll be giving a talk at 4 o'clock this afternoon. That's at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital in room 100 LAC. So people who are interested in this subject, you can go and you can hear more from her. And of course, here on the program, you can listen in and call in with questions. Well, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you, David.
So you apparently have been, among the things you've been studying these animals, the sea otters, for some time now?
Well, yes, the southern sea otters off the coast of California. I got involved in the project in about 1998, but others have been working on sea otters and their population and why it's not recovering for quite some time.
So there were particular concern about their health that is generally, or and then does that go to certain conditions that you were focusing in on?
Well, I don't know if you're at all familiar with these sea otters. Anybody who's come out to California may, especially the coast, had a chance to see them. But these very charismatic, very attractive animals are a federally listed threatened species. Their population was just about devastated in the late 1800s due to the fur trade. They have this luxurious fur coat. And since then, as they've been monitoring their population growth rate, sea otter biologists, particularly in Santa Cruz, have noticed that they just were not, even with the protected status, going back up to the normal numbers. There's only about 2,800 sea otters left. So we started to get involved, the California Department of Fish and Game, some time ago to look at their health. And it turns out that infectious disease is one of the major reasons that their population is not recovering.
Mm-hmm. Particular kinds of infectious disease?
Well, a study that was done looking at that found a number of factors that are affecting them. And this one caused by a little parasite is near the top of the list of causes. It causes a brain disease that kills sea otters.
Mm-hmm. And what is this? What is it that we're talking about?
A little single-celled parasite, a protozoan, that they call Toxoplasma gondii.
Okay. Now, this the connection here between the sea otters and the land, it seems to be that this is a kind of thing that this particular parasite is a thing that is fairly often found in cat waste, in cat feces, both apparently it can be found in wild cats who are living in the wild. I guess that would be feral domestic cats, the feral domestic cat, and also house cats, right?
Yes, this is a parasite that actually can infect a wide variety of animals, probably all warm-blooded animals, some people think including humans. But of all those different hosts that it can infect, there's only one, and that's cats, as you said, David, that actually sheds the parasite in its feces. And that's owned cats, domestic cats, feral cats, and also wild cats, mountain lions, bobcats.
Okay. So it's not just, I guess I was thinking maybe that it was the domestic house cat that ends up as a feral cat. But in fact, wild cats, they can also.
Any of the members of the felids, the cat family, can shed this parasite in their feces.
And there is a concern. I mean, we've had this concern about the possibility of humans being exposed to this, because that's the reason that pregnant women are counseled. If you live a cat in your house, you're just not supposed to have anything to do with the litter. You shouldn't be the one changing the litter box, because you don't want to come into contact with this thing.
Exactly. Most people who have ever heard of toxoplasma think first of that, of the warning to pregnant women not to handle cat litter. I always tell my students, this is a good time to be sure that your partner learns how to clean the cat box.
If he has not been doing it, whoever has not been doing it so far, yes. Now's the time to get them involved in scooping. Can be a very exciting activity. And it is something also that can, in addition to this warning that now people are familiar with about pregnant women, any person, any human could possibly come into contact with, and also be sickened by it?
Well, what happens, David, is that if you become infected, and there's two ways to become infected, either by ingestion of these tough little egg-like stages of the parasite that get in the environment, or by eating the meat from animals that have been infected that way. Those are the two ways that you can become infected. Now, most humans that become infected, you and I, for example, who aren't pregnant and are normal immunologically, we may not even know we've been infected, have no clinical symptoms, or have a flu-like illness that we recover from and never even think of this parasite. So it's the highest people at risk of disease are pregnant women. But then the other population are people who become what we call immunosuppressed. And that means that the ability of your body to fight off an infectious disease agent like this parasite has been compromised. And that can be people who are infected with the HIV virus or have been immunosuppressed in preparation for a tissue transplant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let me just very quickly introduce a guest here in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. Patricia Conrad. She's professor of veterinary medicine at University of California, Davis, at their vet college there, visiting here the campus to talk about some of this research that she and others at UC Davis have been involved in for some time. Questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So you have this... disease-causing organism, you see it and you see the problem that it causes in the sea otters. You see where it is on the land. You see it's in all these cat animals, wild and domestic. So then I guess the big question becomes, how does it get from being deposited one way or another, being deposited on the land, how does it end up in the otters?
I think that's the most intriguing question. And now that we've identified the parasites so that we know what the source is, and can I just clarify, too, the reason that we think the most likely source of infection is from cats is that sea otters don't eat any of those other animals whose tissues might have the toxoplasma parasite in them, as far as we know, as far as others have studied. So that's why we suspect it is this land-sea connection from cats on land getting into the ocean. So how's that happening? Well, the evidence that we have to date suggests that it's from runoff. So in other words, when cats outdoors defecate, or if you dump your litter outdoors, when the rain falls, and in California that happens during the winter, we get all of our rainfall, then that material gets washed, just like soil does, into fresh waterways, and then that gets carried to the ocean. And right now the strongest evidence is that that's how sea otters are getting infected.
And apparently it's because then The disease-causing organism gets washed off the land one way or another. It ends up in the water. Then there are other creatures who live in the water that end up accumulating this stuff. And then the otters eat them, and that's the way that it gets into the otters?
Well, we don't know that for sure. Hmm. It could be that sea otters are getting these parasites from seawater. Others, David Lindsay and his group, they showed that oocysts of toxoplasma, the egg-like stages, can survive for long periods of time, many months. By now, he may have found longer than that in seawater. So it's possible, even though sea otters don't drink much seawater, they are grooming themselves, so they could pick up the oocysts that way. But what's troubling is that such a high proportion of sea otters have this infection. 36 to 38% of sea otters that we've tested have this parasite. So that made us think, could they be getting that much just from a little bit of contamination of the ocean? I mean, the ocean is a huge body of water. It's why we've always allowed things to run into the ocean. We've even dumped our waste into the ocean because we figured it'll all dilute out. So we thought this must be diluted. We don't know that for sure. It might be they're getting it from the seawater. But we also speculated that it could be, just as you said, from concentration in some prey species. And that's why we started to study bivalves. These are like mussels, or what we studied. Others have studied oysters that feed by filtering water, huge amounts of water, and then they take what's in that water that's edible, and they use that to feed themselves. Well, we did experiments to show that, in fact, mussels can concentrate these tiny little parasite stages in their body, and that inside those mussels, the parasites can remain alive. And also be infective if another animal should eat them. Hmm. And so we did those experiments. Others have shown the same is true in oysters. Hmm. But what we haven't shown, no one's shown, is that this actually happens in the wild. And we're looking at that right now to see if there's any mussels out in nature that are have these contaminants of the toxoplasma in them.
Yeah. Has there been some effort to look at, I would guess that there were other animals who also eat those bivalves that might also be susceptible to the same process, to the same disease, and that if you then found that in them, that might also give you another reason to say, well, perhaps this is the avenue of transmission. This is the way it's going.
Well, unless they also were getting infected from water or some other source.
Yeah, I guess.
So we're actually taking a little different approach with a new grant that we just got from the National Science Foundation, amongst the many different things that we're looking at to try to evaluate this land-sea connection and flow that you're asking about. One area is a study of sea otters, and this builds on work that Jim Estes and his group have been doing for a long time in Santa Cruz, where they've been monitoring the sea otters. They have them radio tagged, and they have dive monitors in them too, so they can identify where they are, they can watch them, they can determine how far they dive down, how long they're diving for, and when they come up, they visually inspect what they've brought up. Because what sea otters do is they dive down, they get their prey, then they come back up to the surface, and they lay on their backs on the top of the water, and then they break open the clams, mussels, or eat the squid that they've picked up, or the urchins, and they do all of that activity up top. So they're studying that. So what we're able to do, working with them and the California Department of Fish and Game, is to try to figure out, by sampling these otters that they're monitoring anyway, if there's a correlation between what they're eating and they're getting toxoplasma infection. And that's been a long-term study, but we're really excited because we hope to get those results out sometime this year.
Yeah. Was there some question before about what their feeding habits and patterns were and what they were eating, or was that something that people who specialized in studying sea otters would have been able to tell you if you asked them, so what's your average sea otter eat?
Well, I think that the sea otter biologists had an idea what they were eating. I think one of the exciting things about these studies that Jim Estes and Tim Tinker have done, that was actually Tim's PhD thesis, was that they've found that otters are very selective in what they eat. and that not all otters eat the same thing, and that some are specialists and they specialize on one thing, like bivalves or urchins or clams. So I don't know if they've published that yet, but that makes it a lot easier for us to try to see if there's an association between infection and certain prey that they eat.
Mm-hmm. Well, we went back to talking about in the beginning about the fact that people were that these animals, people were focusing on them and their health, in part because they're just really attractive and because they didn't seem to rebound very well from the point at which they stopped being hunted. And so you identified this particular problem, this particular disease process as being a problem. Are there, do you see it in other animals that live in coastal areas in the water other than the sea otters?
Yes, they have. Other marine mammals have been found to have toxoplasma infections and even die of toxoplasma infections. Dolphins, manatees, we have identified it in seals as a cause of death as well. So that's another reason why we think there must be other ways. Those animals, none of them eat bivalves. Mm-hmm. So there must be other ways that they're getting infected.
Mm. And could that have nothing? We were talking about the connection between cats on the land and this disease in the animals that live on the coastal water. Is there some possibility of someone looking at the idea that, in fact, that the source of the infection could be somewhere else? Maybe it's already in the water and it's not coming from the land.
Well, we know that still, regardless of what else is going on in the marine environment, that these oocysts from cats are getting into the waterways, into mm-hmm. the ocean, and can survive in the sea. But we are also looking at exactly what you're talking about, if there's a marine cycle. In other words, is it everyone says, the people who've worked on toxoplasma for so long, that fish cannot be hosts, but we, and I know other groups, are starting to investigate this. But for all the fish eaters out there, there is no evidence that fish can be infected with toxoplasma gondii at this time. So, mm-hmm. But just to answer that unresolved question, we're investigating that.
Yeah, I suppose that there would be a possibility that there would be something that could be a carrier of this and not get sick from it.
Oh, yes, because most of the true, what we call intermediate hosts, the hosts that have tissue cyst stages in them, those animals don't get sick at all, just like most humans don't. So yes, that's definitely a possibility.
Mm. So is this something that makes cats sick, or is this something that they just carry and it doesn't bother them?
Most cats will have no adverse effects with a toxoplasma infection. There's some nice work done by Mike Lappin at Colorado State University that shows that there's an eye disease that can be associated with toxoplasma infections in cats that may be underdiagnosed, that we should all be thinking about more seriously looking for.
Is this something that domestic house cats that are getting routine vet care, is it something that vets test for?
Usually veterinarians don't test for toxoplasma because it doesn't cause the cat any problems, because the test they would do, which is to look for antibodies in the blood, those are the little agents your cells produce to kill organisms, that they would just tell you whether an animal had ever been infected or not. They're not going to tell you, in most cases, whether the animal is shedding the parasite. So there's really no good reason to test the cat.
Mm-hmm. If then we go to this question of if we're concerned about this problem, so what we want to try to do is whatever can be done to prevent the disease-causing organism, this parasite, from getting into the water and then getting into the otters and anybody else who might be living in the water. I guess you would say that as far as it's difficult as far as the wild cats are concerned to have a whole lot of control, unless what you're talking about are former domestic cats that have become feral cats for one reason or another. And certainly that's a problem. I mean, that's something that one way or another we could do something about. The other part of this would have to do with domestic house cats and what we do with the litter when they're done with it. What sort of things are people thinking about? And is this actually something that's much discussed as a kind of, you know, environmental pollution problem.
Well, there's a lot of points, excellent points that you've made in there. Okay, to begin with, we don't know much about the wild animals, as you pointed out, and how big a problem they are, and that's a very difficult thing to control. What we're looking at specifically, a little bit of that, but also at the owned cats and at feral cats, and looking at the management of owned cats particularly, because as you pointed out, that's something that, that we as cat owners, and I am a cat owner, that we care about, those of us who care about not just wildlife, but human health, because this is a parasite that affects humans, and care about cats, that we need to think about. So what can we do as far as cat owners? I think the best thing is keep our cats inside. If we can do that, and I know how difficult that is myself. I live in the country. I have two stray cats that got dumped at my place, and I have two indoor cats. And I know what it takes to clean litter boxes. I hate it. But if you care about cats, it's best for your cat, its health, its safety, as well as it's best for the environment to keep your cat inside. So that's our strongest recommendation. It just makes sense.
Yeah. I guess I think so, too. I hesitate to use the word own. I'm not exactly sure what the relationship is, but I have lived with some. I have lived under the same roof with some. And I guess I'm also very much of that same feeling that it seems that cats can live perfectly happy, healthy lives without ever going outside. And that it's for other reasons, too. You know, they go outside, they get fleas, the possibility of getting other diseases, they get in fights with other cats, they get hit by cars. You know, there's a lot of reasons why I think it's probably a good thing for cats to stay inside, which you can do if you start with a cat that you've never let go outside. If you have one that's been going outside and then you decide one day you don't want to do that anymore, that might get to kind of be a problem. But I think it's you do run into people who have this idea that, well, somehow you're interfering with the cat's normal life if you just say that that cat's going to be an indoor animal and not go outside. And I don't know, as someone who has lived with them and also is a vet, how do you talk with people about that idea that somehow you're denying the cat some natural expression of its life?
Well, first, let me tell you my own personal experience. You know, I grew up thinking cats should be outdoors. I lived in the country in Colorado, and at certain times we had between 15 and 25 cats that we would let. I mean, I didn't know anything about neutering and spaying cats, or, you know, we gave away kittens. So I do understand that perspective. And also from a personal perspective, my two indoor cats both started out as strays or barn cats. So they were outside. But I'll tell you, they have figured out it is a much safer world inside than it is outside. So now even if the doors open, they go out, they cruise right around the periphery, and they come back. So I've been told that before, that it is a problem if your cat's ever been outside. And so I know the difficulties, and I know there's not a simple solution to this. But I also know you can't train cats, but you can help them to see what's best for them. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to make their indoor environment more pleasant and enjoyable by playing with them, by providing toys, maybe getting them a companion, all of these things. And they will live longer, healthier, and I think happier lives.
Yeah. And I think, too, that you also, we also have to underscore the need for spaying and neutering, because we certainly do have a problem with feral cats. And anybody, if they go down to the local shelter, will see that there are a lot of cats, unwanted cats, cats that need homes, a lot of them are kittens, and that if people just made sure that they were going to have animals that they were neutered, then at least we wouldn't have that problem of unwanted animals.
I think we have to take it very seriously, because right now the estimates are that there are 78 million owned cats in the United States, and possibly up to 73 million feral cats. That's a lot of cats, and the population is increasing dramatically. So I think we have to think, how can we do what's best for the cats as well as for ourselves, the environment, and wildlife?
Yeah, and they also, I know that something that particularly concerns some people is that cats that go outside, domestic cats or others, they do also kill birds. they're hardwired for it. They can't help it. It's not their fault. That's what they do. So that's probably another reason why we'd say, you know, probably it's a good idea overall to just say cat stay indoors.
And those birds and the rodents that they kill, you know, we're not so happy about the birds. I think most of us are pretty happy about the rodent kill, mm-hmm. but except those, unless you actually look at those cute little mice. But anyway, they that is the most likely source of infection for these animals, for cats, is from birds and from rodent prey.
Yeah. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce the guest, Patricia Conrad. She's a veterinarian, doctor of veterinary medicine, professor at University of California, Davis, is here visiting the campus. Talk about the research that she's been involved in that we have been talking about here this morning, specifically this linkage between cats, freshwater runoff, and brain disease in sea otters. This is a lecture, the biennial Norman Levine honorary lecture that honors Norman Levine, who is a very well-known parasitologist here at the University of Illinois. Worked in the field for a long, long time, produced some textbooks that I guess are still sort of definitive books on the subject. She'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Vet Teaching Hospital on West Hazelwood Drive, room 100 LAC. So if you're interested in hearing her speak on the subject, you can stop by. Questions here are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here in a nearby community, Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know how you handle a problem like this. I happen to live next door to a woman who thinks she's the Dr. Doolittle to the whole world. And she has approximately 8 acres, 10 acres, something like that. And on this 10 acres, she has at least 60 feral cats. She brings them in. She accepts cats from any place you can imagine. If they have cats, she wants them. And, of course, now my bird population is tremendously being depleted, along with anything else that happens to run or live or anything else that they seem to put in their mouths and kill. How do you handle a problem like that? That's not right. It should not be allowed to happen.
That's a tough one. I mean, I can understand the woman's perspective that she doesn't want to see cats euthanized and would like to provide them with a home. But if those animals are not spayed or neutered and they're continuing to increase the population, that's a really big problem. Personally, one of the best suggestions that I've heard recommended is to build enclosures and I've seen some designs for these, that if there's a support within the community or if the person really cares about the cats and their well-being, to invest funds in either building enclosure or supporting a humane group that can house those cats indoors. And that will, as I said, be best for the cats, perhaps give them a chance to become tame and to be adopted, certainly also best for the wildlife population. So I don't know if that's feasible, but I think that's, if you really love cats, you need to be thinking that direction.
Well, the unfortunate problem, ma'am, is I have gone to this person and said, look, what you're doing is not right. And the only thing she does is put out some cat food for them, and she wants them to be wild. She thinks it's right for them. And I keep telling her, ma'am, this is not right. You shouldn't do this for many, many reasons. And obviously she does not care. And she does not have the money to build any kind of containment system of all. And I don't know how in the world you get these wild cats back into it, because you can't get any place close to them. No, unless you want to use some kind of projectile, shall I say. And, you know, I don't want to go out and start killing things indiscriminately, but there's something not right here at all. I mean, there should be some sort of law or something, shouldn't there?
Well, I mean, that is an interesting point, because we do have laws in every state, as far as I know, about dogs and about leash laws and about immunizing dogs for rabies and licensing them and everything. And if these were even small dogs instead of cats, as a society, I don't think that we would approve keeping large numbers of small dogs. And yet for cats, we haven't even begun to confront that problem. And with the populations increasing, this is just an example of that. I think we have to be thinking about what we can do. Have you contacted a humane society or a group that might be able to explain this to the lady?
Yes, ma'am. I have contacted the Humane Society, and they say, well, she she takes in dogs, too. She has 20-some dogs, and she takes in horses, too, and she has 5 or 6 horses. They view her as a repository, and I'm not getting any place with this situation. And it just doesn't seem right, because exactly as you say, there's diseases being spread. There are many problems in every way, and I don't want to be painted as a complete cat killer, but I'm rapidly going in that direction, you know, and just it's just a horrid problem.
And I think you probably have to appeal to her sense of her protective sense for cats and her concern about cat welfare, too. Obviously, the other points aren't ones that she relates to. But, I mean, as I confessed, as a child, we had up to 25 cats on our place that we were feeding. But at the time, I didn't know what I know now. And so I think perhaps somebody should talk to her and perhaps the Humane Group, too, about how important it is to for the benefit of those cats to work with her to resolve this problem.
Well, thank you very much, ma'am.
All right, let's go to Urbana. This is another caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm a little more worried about humans myself, right at the moment anyway. I clipped a news article, a press release out of U of I, which I hadn't read until I saw what the topic was today. And it's pretty disturbing. It's from Milton McAllister. And one of the professors here at the U of I, and he was talking about this toxoplasmosis, and he mentions, for example, that studies in the last 3 years have estimated that toxoplasma has infected 25% of adult Americans, 40% of adults in the Netherlands, and 70% in Jakarta, Indonesia, which is kind of interesting because just before that, he says, there's been older studies have shown a high association between toxoplasmosis and psychiatric disorders. And so I thought I'd call up and ask you if you had any kind of recent or if you could flesh out that whole area about how bad it is for humans in general.
Well, those numbers that you cited, Dr. McAllister, who's here on the faculty of the vet school, I've read his paper and also heard him speak at a big parasitology meeting that was in New Zealand, and I've spoken with him about this. And I concur those figures about how the prevalence, and that's people infected, okay, with toxoplasma at some point in their life, that those are from other people's reports, and certainly the 25% in the United States, that is the most correct estimate of the number of people based on blood testing people in the United States. So, yes, what that says is that it is – parasite is fairly prevalent and is infecting people in this country and even more so in other countries where the hygiene is not as good as in this country. So, yes, I think that's important. Then in terms of the mental problems, he was doing a review reporting the studies of a lot of different people that are providing evidence that there may be some association between mental health problems and infection with toxoplasma. I know there was a conference convened recently to discuss that, and the jury's still out as to how close that association is, but I think we're just trying to a number of people are trying to raise awareness that this is something that should be investigated. And as I understand, quite a few different groups worldwide are starting to look more carefully to see if there is an association between infection with toxoplasma and mental health disorders.
Yeah, he mentions, too, that it might be linked with reduced average intelligence. But is this a single-celled parasite that would say live in the brain? Is that what's going on here? Or?
Exactly. It's a single cell parasite that can live, they believe, in perhaps any tissues, but seems to particularly like the brain and the eye.
And the eye.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So what happens is that if a woman gets infected when she's pregnant, that if she doesn't have a miscarriage or abortion, some people it doesn't get to the parasite doesn't get to the fetus, but if it does, she could have a miscarriage, abortion, or the parasite infects the fetus, the infant then is born and can actually look normal at birth, can have birth defects, but sometimes looks normal at birth, and then later it's found out has most often its eye or brain problems that are associated with the infection.
Do we have any effective chemical or medicinal methods of killing off the parasite?
There are drugs that are used to treat the active infection, and so they're most successful in these HIV/AIDS patients. I didn't really explain that. What happens with HIV/AIDS? These are people who could be infected any time in their life, and then the parasites have insisted in their tissues, like they are probably in the tissues of these 25% of people that are infected in the United States, and stay there. And then when the parasite realizes it's not being controlled, they come out. Now, when those parasite stages are coming out and just getting to the brain and causing disease, then these drugs can be used to effectively treat the parasite. What's problematic is that when the parasites are insisted, they're sort of like hibernating, if you will. They've gone really quiet and they're hiding in the tissues. Drugs are not very effective at killing those parasite stages.
Great. The reason I was a little bit concerned about this is because I just noticed that one of the neighbor's cats has taken to using part of my lawn as a litter box, and whenever I mow it, it throws up a smell, which I'm sure might have some of these oocytes in it. I'm correct in that, am I not?
Well, that these oocysts, these environmentally tough egg-like stages, are in the cat feces. So wherever a cat that may be shedding them should defecate, they could possibly be there. Now, the good news is that cats aren't shedding these all the time. That what studies have shown is that cats that are infected for the first time usually only shed for a week or two. It's just that during that period of time, they can shed large numbers of these parasites, up to tens of millions or more. Sometimes they don't. They just shed a few. And then they usually don't shed again. And it's thought, well, studies have shown that only about 1 to 2% of cats are shedding oocysts in their feces at a given time. For example, in a study, if you're studying them, only about 1 to 2% of the animals that you're looking at their feces will be shedding parasites. So that's the good news, is that it's not like they're shedding all the time. The bad news is that these parasite stages can survive in the environment for a very long time, probably less so here in Illinois, where you get a good solid freeze at least once or twice a year. But in California, where we don't get that, there's not much except for intense UV and that could kill them in the soil.
Well, that's good to know. The freeze might clean out the problem. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Patricia Conrad. She's professor of veterinary medicine, University of California, Davis, and is visiting here to talk about this research that she's been doing. She'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital on the U of I campus. And to hear more questions, welcome, certainly. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, now just to talk a little bit more about toxoplasma and human beings, it can't be that if human beings are being infected that they're all being infected because they've come into contact with infected cat waste. What are some of the other ways that it's thought that human beings would come in contact with this, and it could pick up this protozoa?
Right. Single-celled parasite, okay, that we call protozoas.
Yeah. Okay.
So the other major way is if you ate meat that was uncooked or undercooked, and those tissues contained these tissue cyst stages of the parasite, you could become infected. Now, the sort of animals that this would be the greatest risk of having these in the tissues might be some wildlife. We know there have been some studies to show a fairly high proportion of, in some areas, of deer and bear might be infected with toxoplasma. In most places, we haven't even studied it. And then in terms of our normal food animals, sheep and pigs have, in many countries, been the animals most infected with toxoplasma. Now, the good news in the United States is that we've done a lot through the efforts of the USDA and their studies to show how pigs were getting infected and to put in place ways of preventing pigs from getting infected on farms. And the last that I heard, the proportion of pigs in this country, market pigs that were infected, was almost negligible, that they've dramatically reduced this. And then also in this country, we cook our pork before we eat it. And we don't eat a lot of lamb in this country. And I don't know how there haven't been the same kind of studies on sheep with toxoplasma, but I think it's the fact that in this country we cook our meat so much more that has prevented that from being such a major source of infection, as it is, for example, in France. In France, the proportion of infected people is much higher, and so much so that all women who are getting married, I'm told, have to be tested for toxoplasma, because if they're already infected, it's not a problem. If they aren't infected, they monitor them throughout their pregnancy to make sure that they haven't gotten infected while they're pregnant. So the French like their meat less cooked.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. Someone in Stell. That's our toll-free line. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is a most illuminating conversation, and I'm appreciating it very much. Looking at the idea of raising animals indoors, however, I mean, and we're looking at that now with the avian flu, that all the food-productive birds should be raised indoors to protect them from exposure to these organisms. Living things really cannot live indefinitely enclosed without access to the sun. Now, if we built cages that permitted the sun but protected them from the external environment, that would be something, but I doubt that that's ever going to happen. I mean, pigs won't even propagate. They won't even reproduce if they don't have exposure to the sun. And I'm sure that there are many other animals that are the same way. It doesn't seem practical to me to be suggesting that all cats and all chickens, so forth, be raised indoors. It seems like somehow we must become more rational about the whole thing. We don't need all these feral animals. We don't even need all the owned pets. We're such a country of excess now. It seems like it would be valuable if we could grow up about our emotional involvement with these things and become more cognizant of what we have to do to protect the environment.
Well, if I can comment, I certainly agree we have to come up with practical solutions, and I certainly agree with your comments about the importance of the sun for all of us and our animals. I think that this has already, as I indicated, been pretty effectively managed by the pork industry here, the swine production industry in the United States, and they have worked out ways to reduce the exposure of pigs to toxoplasma while still maintaining the housing facilities that the pigs need. So I'd like to speak to the cat thing. The structures that I've seen ideas for would include windows, an opportunity for animals to have a healthy exposure to the outdoors without actually having to be outdoors. So I do think that needs to be taken into consideration.
Hmm. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're getting down to about our last 5 minutes or so, and I want to make sure that if there are other people who are listening and want to get in the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Something else that I've read in a couple of things that I've read here, and I apologize for anybody who's tired of hearing us talk about cats, something that goes back to the domestic house cat that seems some people apparently think might be a problem, is flushable litter. Now, I didn't even know such a thing existed, but apparently it does, and that there is some concern that, I guess you would think that if you're flushing the waste and it's going through the sanitary treatment that all the waste goes through, that should take care of the problem. But apparently the kind of treatment that they do won't take care of the toxoplasmosis causing organism. Is that right?
Well, these are really tough parasites. I mean, very difficult to kill. We're doing experiments right now to find out exactly what it's going to take to kill oocysts. We know chlorination doesn't do it. Ozone treatment isn't effective. And I can't speak to all wastewater management systems, but certainly having toured a number of facilities, some really good facilities in California, that the treatments that are now in place were not guaranteed. In other words, they're not the kind that we can with confidence say would kill oocysts. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we're alerting people to this fact, because I think the development of flushable cat litter is very well intentioned. So it's perhaps we need to look at our wastewater treatment operations and look at those seriously. And as I say, I'm not an expert on that, but we just wanted to draw attention to the fact that just flushing your cat feces down the toilet is not going to ensure that you kill these parasites. And certainly don't dump it outside. Our recommendation is to take your cat litter, bag it up, and send it to the landfill, which I know adds to the problem of the landfills, but those are the only places where, by regulation, at least in California, I know, they are supposed to control water runoff. So the chances of infectious disease agents getting into the groundwater or into freshwater systems is least there.
Yeah. We'll try to get at least one more caller here, but I guess I'm interested in making giving you the opportunity to make a sort of a larger point, because we have been talking about a very specific kind of problem affecting specific animals. But it does, in a larger sense, say that, kind of as I said at the beginning, that different ecosystems, they might seem to be separate, but they're not. And that different kinds of animals might seem to be separate, and humans and animals might seem to be separate, but they're not. That we're all tangled up together, and stuff that we do one place really does affect what happens someplace else.
I think that's the most important point, David, right there, is that what the sea otters are telling us is, as sentinels living their entire life in the near coast environment, is that there's not a division between the land and the sea. And what we do on the land and what our pets do, in fact, on land affects other wildlife and actually affects our health. In this case, you know, we talk about avian flu, we talk about West Nile virus, where wildlife are reservoirs for infectious disease agents. In this case, sea otters can't give the parasite to anyone. They're actually the victims, but they're also the ones that are saying, hey, pay attention. And I think what we've just talked about is true for a lot of infectious disease agents, that we have to look at what we do, our animals, our interaction with wildlife and the environment, and really make some sound management decisions on those principles.
We'll see if we can get at least one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Couple of things. One, the last comment you just made I think was really great, because with the previous caller, I know that, you know, it's very difficult, that boundary between pets and wildlife and all of that. And, you know, but I think also as Americans, we're too used to living in a sterile world where we can control everything, and we forget there's millions of these kinds of organisms and things out there, and people in third world countries experience that regularly. But my real question is, If you get toxoplasmosis, how long do you have it? I mean, do you have it for your whole life and you just have symptoms at certain periods? Or, as you become, say, if you get older and your immune system becomes more weakened, are you at risk then for this disease to come out again? Or do people shed these organisms like the cats do? Or what happens with that?
Okay, so we have to distinguish between getting infected with toxoplasma and developing disease, the disease being toxoplasmosis. So if you get infected with toxoplasma, it's believed that, like most animals, the parasite may stay in your body for years, maybe for your life. And most people will just stay there and never cause any problems. The evidence is that it's severe immunosuppression, like HIV or chemical immunosuppression for transplants that's needed for the parasite to come out and go to your brain. Okay, that's the evidence. And you will not shed the parasite. Only felids are known to shed the parasite and contaminate the environment. And the earlier question that was brought up about the mental health, all that is raising the possibility that subclinical infections might be something that we look at. In other words, that there may be some effects that we don't know about. But those haven't been proven. Those are things that are being studied right now. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Well, we, I think, are going to have to leave it at that. And my apologies, we have one caller that we cannot take, but we're just pretty much here at the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Patricia Conrad from University of California, Davis. She's professor of veterinary medicine there. She's here visiting to talk about this very work that she's been involved in. And that will be this afternoon at the vet school, at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital on West Hazelwood. And that's in room 100 LAC, talking about linkages between cats, freshwater runoff, and brain disease in sea otters. This is the biennial Norman Levine Honorary Lecture, endowed by Dr. Jorge and Marianne Guerrero. And if it's free and open to the public, I'm sure anybody who was interested in attending will be there. I'm sure everybody in the vet school will be there, and there are probably a lot of other folks as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.